On this episode of the Fear Me Out podcast, I'd like to spend an hour talking about what I call miracles. Now, I've talked to a lot of people about the idea of doing a podcast on miracles, and a lot of people say to me, well, how do you know that the things that happen that you're going to describe are not just coincidences? And you know, I can't really answer that question. So I guess it kind of depends on what you see as a miracle. I mean, usually miracles are looked at as a religious phenomenon. Because I'm not a religious person, I don't see them from that perspective. I feel like trusting your intuition can often lead to having miracles in your life. Most of them are small, relatively insignificant things that you might get a feeling about or just wonder about. Other times, major things take place that are kind of hard to explain. Some people could explain them by describing them as being, you know, a biological phenomenon or, you know, just a coincidence in your life. But I want to talk about them from the perspective of being miracles, because I believe that in my own life, I've had a lot of them happen, you know, along with all the terrible stuff. I've also had some pretty amazing things take place. There are two basic motivating forces, fear and love. When we're afraid, we pull back from life. When we're in love, we open up to all that life has to offer with passion, excitement, and acceptance.
Coming to you from our studio in Santa Barbara, California, this is the Fear Me Out podcast. We're not your typical self-help program. Our show takes a deep dive into those psychological issues that affect us on a daily basis. We hope to shift your perspective and have you experiencing emotions differently. Now, Dr. Dana Saperstein.
So when I was thinking about miracles, I guess the first, you know, descriptive miracle that I can talk about was when I was 4 years old, lived in Brazil. And one morning, my family was scheduled to go to the circus in Brazil. We'd been to the circus the week before and had so much fun that we wanted to go back again and experience it one more time. But that morning, when we all woke up, my little brother, who was probably maybe a little over one year old, he woke up kind of fussy and having a really tough time kind of settling. And he was really, really irritable, screaming, crying. And so my parents got the idea that maybe it wasn't the best idea to take him into an environment like that. And so we skipped going to the circus. Well, what we found out the next morning was that when we were scheduled to be at the circus that previous afternoon, the circus caught on fire. It burned down to the ground and everybody in the circus tent died. So if my little brother hadn't been fussing, we wouldn't be here right now. We all would have died in the circus arena. So when I look back on that, I mean, I can't really say that it was a miracle. It sure seems like one. I mean, my brother was not physically ill. He just was really having a hard time. And, you know, it's like when people miss an airplane or, you know, and then the plane crashes or whatever. We missed going to the circus and we all lived as a result of that. That's a pretty amazing situation. Again, I can't say it's not just a coincidence, but to me, when I look back, I was really stunned when my parents remind me of this situation when I was much older. The next situation that I consider to be a miracle has to do with a person that my parents hired when I lived in Brazil to come and take care of us when we were kids. She was a woman from a refugee from Yugoslavia that fled to Brazil during the World War II, and her job was taking care of kids. So my parents hired this woman. Her name was Kruna. I have a very clear, really, really crystal clear vision of her, what she looked like, what she sounded like. And I fell in love with this woman. I followed her around like I was like a little duckling following my mother. And what I felt from her was an experience of love that I'd yet to feel in the course of my life. I feel like I fell in love with Kruna, and she taught me what clean love felt like. And I just remember every time I saw her, I would just light up, and I wanted to spend every waking moment in her presence because my dad was absent, and my mom was, you know, so anxious that she wasn't really there. So Kruna, in my mind, taught me love in a way that I'd never experienced before, and I look at that as being a miracle. And the weird thing is that she was only in my life for 9 months, which is kind of symbolic in a certain way. And I also remember pleading with my parents when we decided to leave Brazil to bring Kruna with us, because in my mind, I felt like she was my real mom. And I couldn't even imagine not having her in my life. Well, I think that on some level, my mom was probably pretty jealous of how enamored I was with her. And I don't think my dad was paying any sort of attention at all. So sadly, we left her behind. And I remember sitting in the airport, we were having lunch, and there was classical music playing. And to this day, every time I hear classical music, I feel incredible deep sadness of leaving this person that was really responsible for teaching me about love. So that's a different kind of miracle in my mind. Again, I don't know if you want to look at it as a coincidence. To me, it feels like a pretty amazing thing to have someone come into your life when you're almost 5 years old and teach you what the real, true, deep meaning of love felt like. So from Brazil, we ended up in California. And the summer before school started, I would go to the playground every day and play with my brother. And he was probably maybe 2.5 or so, almost 3. I was crossing the street at the school to go to the playground, and a truck turned left and actually hit me. So I actually got run over by a truck. I got hit by the truck. I flew up in the air and landed on my butt. And for some odd reason, I didn't get hurt. I mean, I don't know how you can get hit by a pickup truck as a little kid and fly in the air and land and not even be hurt by the situation. So I remember getting up and looking around and wondering, you know, what the heck that was all about. And the sort of funny part of the story was the guy got out of the truck, you know, wanting to make sure I was okay. But I thought he was coming to kill me. So I started running home. And my little better brother was running behind me. We were about a half a block from home. And my brother was screaming and hitting the guy, saying, "You leave my brother alone." Because I guess my brother got scared that he was going to continue to harm me. But, you know, luckily he followed us home and made sure that whoever, I think it was my grandma at that time, was at home. And he told her what happened. And but I was unhurt in any way. So I don't know how you can get hit by a truck and fly up in the air and be okay, but somehow I landed softly enough to not cause myself any damage. So again, I look at that as being kind of miraculous that I didn't get hurt, but, you know, again, maybe I'm not seeing the situation correctly, but I feel pretty amazed that I survived that experience. I'm sure there were a bunch of other stuff that happened between, you know, that period of time. I know that when I was, maybe 13 years old, and this is, you know, again, a debatable miracle. My father came home from work one day, and he had 2 brand new surfboards in the back of his car. Now, he was working with a woman whose son bought these surfboards and then went off to Vietnam during the Vietnam War and actually got killed. So he never got a chance to use these surfboards. They were just sitting in the garage. And somehow the woman that owned the surfboard sort of had the idea that maybe myself and my brother might enjoy having new surfboards. So my dad brought these surfboards home, and I was just completely floored by this miracle, because as soon as I brought the boards to the beach for the first time, they were actually too big for us to carry on our own. It took 2 of us to carry these boards down to the water. And the very first moment that I laid on the surfboard and started, you know, paddling and trying to learn how to surf, I was completely awestruck. And having those surfboards changed my life, and I became a lifelong surfer. And for anybody that has fallen in love with surfing, it's not just a sport. To me, it touched me on the deepest level. And has accounted for some of the most amazing experiences I've ever had in my life, being in the ocean and riding waves. And I was able to carry that through until, sadly, I got so injured that I wasn't able to surf anymore. But that lasted for 45 years. So getting those surfboards to me, again, was another major turning point in my life in a very positive way. So we can fast forward now to when I was 39 years old. It was 1989. And I was invited, well, at this particular time in my life, I started having terrible nightmares about 6 months before the end of the year. And every single night, I would have the same dream. I dreamt that I was being chased around a green-tiled room by a man with a syringe, and the man was trying to kill me. So I would wake up in a panic, hip flailing. I was actually really worried that I might hurt my wife. And this was after I'd already had at least 10 years of really, really in-depth therapy, and thought that I'd sort of taken care of every nook and cranny inside my soul. But all of a sudden, the terrible nightmare started on, and couldn't figure out what was going on. I went back to see my mentor, who was quite instrumental in my life, and he couldn't help me. He said, I have no idea what to tell you about this, because, you know, again, he was my therapist for a long time and pretty much miraculous experience with him, too, saving my life. Again, I'm going to talk a bit aside of this particular experience. When I first moved to Santa Barbara, I went to a professor at UCSB, and he was a psychology professor, and I said, hey, I want to get into therapy. Can you help me out? I don't know anybody in town. And so he gave me the names of two or three people, but when I called, Irwin was the person that answered the phone. And I have to say that Irwin Bloom became my, I think he saved my life in a lot of ways, and also became my mentor. And he convinced me to become a psychologist, which is pretty amazing event in my life, and wouldn't happen without him. So I went back to see him. He couldn't really help me. So I was invited, my wife and I and our kids were invited to a New Year's Eve party, a very small gathering, with some recent acquaintances. And we arrived at their house at around 8 o'clock or so, and the kids went off to play. And a woman that was friends with the fellow, Alan, that invited us to the party, showed up at the party and sat down on the couch next to me. I had never met this woman before, knew nothing about her. But she was sitting with a pad and a paper, and she said to me, you know, I understand that you're having this experience in your life where you're curious about, you know, why you're having a particular nightmare. So she picked up the pad and the paper, and she started writing really intensely. And I'm kind of thinking, well, this is a really weird thing to have happen at a party. You know, that you meet somebody and they carry around a pad and paper, and she just started writing like a maniac. And then after about 10 or 15 minutes, she handed me the pad. And as soon as I started reading what she wrote, I had the most intense flash of what my nightmare was all about. She actually began writing the story of what happened to me, that I had very deeply repressed. When I was 4 years old, I went into the hospital to have hernia surgery. Back in those days, your parents dropped you off at the hospital, and they couldn't stay. You know, that was not the way things worked back in those days. So I'm in the hospital, and I'm getting ready for bed, and an orderly comes in, and he sexually molests me while I'm there. And then he tells me that if I tell anybody about what he did to me, that he would kill me. So the next morning, he wheeled me into surgery, and I was really, really scared because I thought, you know, that he was going to cause me harm. And, you know, when I was laying on the operating table and they were putting me under anesthesia and I started to lose consciousness, I really clearly remember screaming at the top of my lungs, I won't tell, I won't tell, because I thought they were killing me at the time. incredibly traumatic, horrible experience that I completely blocked out for the next 30 years of my life. And with all the therapy I had, with all the introspection, all the, the idea that I was sexually abused never came up in any way, shape, or form. But this woman, her name was Catherine. She was a very instrumental person in my life for two reasons. Number one, she helped me heal probably the deepest trauma that I ever experienced by writing, a description of what took place. And I so clearly remember everything once I started to read the description. But the salutation on the paper said, God, comma. So what she was doing was writing me a letter from God. Now, again, at this moment in time, when I first met Catherine, I was very deeply suspicious of and very down on any sort of spiritual life, any kind of religious experience, any kind of notions of God, because I made the same mistake that most people do and believe that the only way to have a relationship with God was through organized religion. And I hated the religion that I was brought up in. I was forced to participate against my will. So I was very antagonistic toward anything of a spiritual nature. But because this experience was so life-changing and so momentous, I woke up the next morning actually not really able to deny the existence of God anymore and really amazed at the healing experience that I was provided under these circumstances. So my life changed really drastically at that point because I thought to myself, well, if I could learn to do what Catherine does in my own way, it would really change the way that I live in the world and especially change my professional life as a therapist. So Catherine and I started meeting. She started writing for me on a regular basis. And fortunately, I was able to start to develop a very strong connection to God. And I was able to have a lot of my questions answered about many, many things that I never thought I would understand. So I look at my meeting with Catherine as very, very miraculous. You know, how would somebody who had only known me for 10 minutes of my life be able to know something that deeply about me that I didn't even remember happened and then bring it to me in a way that was so, I was so awestruck and as skeptical a guy as I am capable of being, I wasn't able to figure out a way to make this, not real. So over the course of time, maybe, 6 months later, I remember going to sleep and I was in kind of a scared place. I wasn't sure whether all the major changes that happened as a result of my developing a spiritual life were real. I was really, really scared. And I remember going to sleep thinking, okay, God, I really don't understand what your purpose in my life is. I'm not sure if I should even believe that any of this is real. It would be so easy for me to go back to being skeptical and cynical about all of this. So in the middle of the night, I'm not sure if I was awake or dreaming, but I had this experience where I guess it was in the form of a dream that I was living back at the house that I went to high school in. Now, I hadn't lived in that house for, 15 years at least or more. My parents didn't even own that house anymore, but I went back as the 30-some-odd-year-old person that I was, and I'm sitting in the house, and there's a knock at the door. And I go to the door, open the door, and God is standing there. Now, what God explained to me in that moment is that God had to show up as a person, but that God is not a person. But in order for us to have a conversation, there had to be somebody for me to talk to. So that's why God showed up as a man in that moment. And so I, said to God, what are you doing here? And God said, well, I came to answer your questions. I want you to know my purposes in your life, and I want you to truly understand what my existence in your life is all about. And I thought, well, that sounds wonderful. That's, kind of when I went to sleep really pondering. And so I said, okay, God, what's the deal? And God said, well, the first thing that I want you to know is that I am always present in your life. I'm always there. The only time that you don't feel me is when you turn away from me. And if you ever want to feel that feeling of love and connection, all you got to do is think about me and I will be there. And again, the only time you won't feel me is when you turn from me, because I never turn away from anyone. And I thought that was, you know, pretty remarkable. And so I said, okay, that sounds really good. Anything else? And God said, yes. Human beings have a really difficult time dealing with forgiveness. So part of my role in your life is to help you forgive the people that have hurt you, to gain forgiveness from the people that you've hurt, and also for you to forgive yourself for the way that you have treated yourself, because most people talk to themselves and treat themselves very poorly. They lie to themselves, as I've talked about in a previous podcast. And so I thought, okay, that sounds pretty amazing. I really can appreciate the idea that forgiveness is really important in us, for us to, you know, get past especially trauma and move on with our lives. And I said, okay, God, is there anything else? And God said, yeah, there's one more thing that I would like to talk to you about at this moment in time. And that's that because you've chosen a profession to be of service and you've devoted your life to helping people, you don't need to be afraid. I will always be there with you and I'll provide you anything that you need in order to help the people that find their way to you. So whoever finds their way to you is finding their way to you for a reason. And you don't have to be afraid of how much pain that they're in, because I'm here to help you and support you in helping those people heal. And I just thought, wow, that is such an incredible gift. I was so happy about that. And I said to God, well, is there anything else? And God said, no, that pretty much covers it for now. And so I said to God, well, can you just hold on for a minute while I go get my wife? So I'm running around the house, calling my wife, and she comes to the door, and God is not there. And the message I get is that it's not my job to introduce my wife to God. That's her personal journey. So the dream vision sort of came to an end, and I was sitting in my bed, wide awake, with just such an overwhelming feeling of peace. And then I heard music playing inside my head. Now, I have to be honest, I've never heard music like this before, and I've never heard music like it since, but it was the most amazing music I had ever heard. Couldn't even describe it, other than the fact that it was just so awe-inspiring. So I thought to myself, boy, what is this? And the final message I got is, this is what the angels sound like when they're singing in heaven. So that sort of rounded out that evening and really, really changed my life in a very dramatic way. It was much easier for me to accept having a really strong connection to God. Pretty amazing event in my life. So again, moving forward, I'm kind of skipping around, but when I was 45, one morning, I woke up to go surfing. Usually on Wednesday mornings, I would meet my friends. Luckily enough, we all, for whatever reason, had Wednesday morning off. So every day for, God, at least 20 years, we would meet and surf together, which was really a lovely way to break up the week, being with people that I'd known, some of them since junior high school. So anyway, I get to the beach before all of my friends, and I'm standing at the pathway looking out over the ocean. And it was a really beautiful January morning, absolutely stunning. And the waves were actually perfect and there was nobody in the water. Now, again, most people don't really understand what it means when there's nobody in the water and you want to go surfing. That rarely, rarely happens, especially in Central California. Usually every surf break has a million people in it. And, you know, the biggest problem is too many people, not enough. Not having enough people. So I was standing there looking at the waves, getting super excited and getting ready to put my wetsuit on to jump in the water. And what it felt like to me is somebody was yelling at me at the top of their lungs, don't go in the water by yourself. It wasn't don't go in the water, but don't go in the water by yourself. And I kept thinking to myself, well, I can't wait. I mean, my friends will be here soon. It's not going to be a problem. I really don't want to wait, because you rarely get perfect waves with nobody around. So I wanted to get in the water desperately. But that voice of don't go in the water was so strong that I actually finally gave in and said, okay, all right, you know, I'll wait. So I waited for my friends. We all got our wetsuits on, paddled out in the water. And then 10 minutes later, I had what would have been a fatal heart attack in the water. And the only reason I'm alive is because my friends saw me paddling in and I collapsed on the rocks and they came and they saved my life. Now, if I was alone, I would have just died either in the water or on the shore, because nobody could have saved me. The heart attack was so severe that I would have died for sure. So again, I see that as a fairly miraculous event. Other people have said to me, well, you probably just unconsciously knew something was going to happen. And but I choose not to look at it that way. I choose to look at it from the perspective that I was being cared for. Now, again, my relationship with God is not such that God can control anything. And so there was no way to prevent the heart attack. But what I was warned against was having a heart attack without people there to save me. And I look at that as actually a fairly remarkable event. Again, that's a health-related situation. So I'm going to skip back a ways to when I was about 20 years old. I lived in San Diego, had a roommate, and I was going to college. And one morning, both of us kind of woke up and decided, and I'm not even sure how this happened, that we wanted to move to Hawaii. And it was such a strange sort of idea to drop out of college and move to a place like Hawaii. And back in those days, this was 1976, going to Hawaii was fairly exotic compared to the places where people travel now to go surfing. So he and I decided that we were going to move to Hawaii. We didn't know anything about it. I'm not even sure why we chose to go to Maui. I have no idea. We just bought airplane tickets and ended up at the airport about a month later. And we were just kind of standing there. We didn't even know what to do once we got there. We're just standing there like idiots in the, at the outside of the terminal. And some guy came up to us and said, you know, what are you guys doing here? And we said, well, we just got off the plane. We have no idea where to go or what to do because we decided to move here, but we don't know what we're doing. And the guy kind of looked at us. I think he took pity on us. He said, you know, throw your stuff in my truck. And he drove us across the island to Lahaina, which is a place that actually burnt down fairly recently. But he dropped us off at a hotel in Lahaina, and we spent the night there. The next morning, my friend Kim and I were sitting in the pool trying to figure out, you know, well, now what do we do? We, you know, we needed to find jobs and a place to live and all of that stuff. So we're sitting in the pool, and some man comes up to us and says, hey, what are you guys doing here? And we looked at him like, well, why do you care, right? And he said, what are you doing? I said, well, we just moved here and we got to find jobs. And he said, well, what do you guys, what kind of experience do you guys have? And both of us had a lot of experience working as waiters. And so he said to me, wow, I'm opening up a really fancy Italian restaurant next week. Can I hire you guys to be my waiter? So he hired us in the swimming pool. The only requirement we had was to go to the tuxedo rental shop on Maui and buy some tuxedo shirts, a cummerbund, and a pair of tuxedo pants because it was a pretty fancy restaurant. So we go to the tuxedo shop. The only color that they would sell us was pink. So both of us had pink ruffled shirts and we're ready to come to work. So as far as work goes, we were set up right away. So the next day we woke up and decided we needed to kind of figure out where to live. And we had no idea where to look or what to do. But somebody mentioned to us that, you know, we should hitchhike a little bit north of Lahaina because it's a little bit easier to find places to live and it's cheaper. So we're standing by the side of the road. In Hawaii, you can't stick your thumb out to hitchhike. So we're just standing there looking like idiots. And all of a sudden a car stopped. And we look in the car and I thought, I know that this person. Well, it turns out that the woman in the car was one of my neighbors in San Diego. I had no idea that she was moving to Hawaii. She said she'd moved there a couple of weeks ago and asked us what we were doing there. And we said, well, we're looking for a place to live and kind of find a car. We already have a job. So she said, oh, the apartment next to where I live is coming up for rent next week. Why don't you come and take a look? So she brought us to the apartment. And it was perfect for our needs. So we got a place to live. And the people that were moving away sold us their car. So within 2 days, we had jobs, a place to live, and transportation. The funny thing about the car was that it was so rusted out that you could look at the floorboard and see the road underneath. But we couldn't really be very choosy because we didn't have much money. Anyway, we were completely set up within 2-3 days. And I think that that's actually pretty remarkable that things were so smooth and easy. Well, the next thing that happened was that somebody told us about a fairly remote beach about 10 miles north of where we were living. And the way that you would get to the beach was to climb down a hill. So it wasn't a very popular beach. And at this point in time, that part of the island was not even developed. It was all pineapple fields. So we started hanging out at this beach. And one day when we got there, it was my friend Kim and I and another friend that we'd met. And we walked down the path, and there are three women, the only people on the whole beach, three women that were sort of camped out there for the day. And I sat down. The three of us sat down, and I keep looking at these women. And one of them, I just couldn't stop staring at her. I just thought that she was the most gorgeous woman I'd ever seen in my life. But she also looked quite young, so I kept saying to myself, God, Dana, you're such a perv. You know, why are you staring at this 14-year-old girl? She's, you know, not even old enough for you to have an interest. And I will say that at this point in my life, I was so shy that there's no way in the world that I would have ever approached a woman, whatever her age was, to ask her out or anything. I was just painfully shy. So we spent the next couple hours there. And at this point in time, there were still the reefs in Hawaii were still alive. So we would go out snorkeling and find shells and all kinds of interesting stuff out in the water. So I went out by myself. I'm swimming around, and I'm just walking up the beach, getting out of the water after I found some really pretty swells. And it turns out that this woman that I'd been staring at, I was sitting on the beach by herself. So I don't know what possessed me. I sat down next to her, and it was absolutely love at first sight. I was just so consumed by how amazingly beautiful. And, you know, we started chatting. It turns out that she's actually about 6 months older than me. So I got relieved of my perv ideas. And we had a really lovely chat for about a half an hour. And then right before she was getting ready to leave, she mentioned to me that she was there with her two sisters on vacation. She just graduated nursing school and wanted to spend a month in Hawaii. So I said to her in passing, and again, no idea where the bravery came from, I said to her, well, there's a club that we go dancing sometimes. Why don't you meet us there? And, you know, maybe we can all dance and have fun. So she said, well, I'm not really sure how my sisters would think, you know, what they'd think about that. They have boyfriends. You know, I have a boyfriend, whatever. So I thought, well, oh, well, I'll never see this person again. So we decided to go to the club that night anyways, and we're sitting there for hours, and they never showed up, and we were just getting up to leave, and they walked in the door. And this woman, Susan, and I just, it was like being struck by lightning. Both of us were so drawn to each other. So we started dancing and really having a fun time. And then we spent the next couple of weeks completely inseparable. It was really amazing. Hawaii is a very romantic place, and we fell madly in love with each other. The big hiccup was that she was in a relationship with someone, a really serious relationship, and she's not the kind of person that would ever be unfaithful, but our attraction was so strong that we pretty much couldn't resist keeping our hands off each other. But Susan's sister panicked and called the boyfriend and called dad and said, hey, you know, my sister have lost her mind. Your girlfriend's lost her mind. She's hanging out with some you know, hippie dude, surfer guy. So you better come and, you know, figure out what the heck's going on. So a boyfriend decides to come to Hawaii. And Susan then tells me that she feels so guilty and overwhelmed by the situation that she can't see me ever again. So I thought that I'd lost her forever. I walked around moping for weeks afterwards because I've never had that experience before, falling so in love with somebody in such a short period of time. But I just thought I'd lost her because she went back to the mainland and living in San Francisco where she was from. But somehow she kept my parents' address. And I wrote her a couple letters, but She never got those letters because I think her mom intercepted them and threw them away because they wanted no part of me in her life. And about a year later, I had moved to Santa Barbara at this time. And I would think about her every once in a while, but figured it, you know, that was the end of whatever. But one day I got home and there was a letter from her. And I remember thinking to myself, you know, it took me so long to get over my brief knowing her that I'm not sure if I want to take a chance again of you know, being hurt like this. So I left the letter kind of sitting on my desk for a couple of days before I had the courage to open the letter. I opened the letter and she explained to me that she'd gone back to San Francisco, broke up with her boyfriend. There was a big earthquake in Guatemala at the time. So she left with a medical team to go to Guatemala for a year to help the really poor Indians up in the mountains. And she'd just gone home and thought she would send me a note saying hello. And then we just started seeing each other again and going back and forth between San Francisco and Santa Barbara. And eventually I said to her, I can't do this anymore. It's too painful every time you leave. And she said, well, I can't upset my life. I can't, you know, I can't move away. And so we kind of broke up, but she made it all the way to the airport in San Francisco and called me and said, okay, I'm coming. We've been together ever since. And this was 1977, I think. So we've been together for a really long time. Luckily, she's still willing to put up with me. I think that it was a miracle how everything manifested itself for us to meet each other and spend our lives together. So I know I'm skipping around a bit in time, but pretty amazing experience as far as I'm concerned. So moving on a bit in my life, when I went to school to get my PhD in psychology, every day that I was in school and talked to people in Santa Barbara, they would tell me that there was no way in the world you could make a living as a psychologist in Santa Barbara, that the area was saturated with therapists and that it would be impossible to make a living. So I got really scared by all the negative information I was receiving. And so Susan and I thought maybe we would move to Seattle. So we took a trip up there and I actually got offered a job and we were thinking about coming back and moving. But when I got back to Santa Barbara, I was driving downtown and somebody went through a stop sign and I crashed into them. It was a relatively minor accident, but enough so that I needed to get some treatment. So I went to see a doctor that I'd been told about that was a really amazing guy. And that what he was doing at this particular location was, it was a multidisciplinary practice. There was a chiropractor next door, a physical therapist next door to them, and then this doctor, Alan Tomaszewski, was the main guy in the medical part of things. And so I met him. He was very kind, and he told me that the best thing to do would be to get massage. And he had a massage therapist working in his office. And so the first time I was getting a massage, I was looking around. It was probably the most beautiful office I'd ever been in for a medical situation. So I said to the massage person, man, this is such an amazing place. I would love to work in a place like this. And I was just saying it just, you know, for no other reason, but admiring how lovely it was. Well, what I didn't know is that Alan and his wife were looking for a psychologist to join their practice. So she told Alan, the massage therapist told Alan that at what I mentioned. And so the next time I came in for an appointment, he said, hey, I hear you're looking for a place to practice. And my wife and I would love to interview you because we've heard some nice things about you. And if we want you, you can come and join our practice here. And I just thought to myself, oh, this is like beyond amazing. The biggest problem with the whole thing was that the rent that they wanted to charge me was triple any rent that I would ever pay for an office in Santa Barbara. And at this point in time, I was barely making a living and my wife and I were barely getting by. So it was a really, really scary decision to make. But again, I had such a strong feeling that this was the right thing to do for me. So we gave up our plans of moving away and I started working with Alan, and within 6 months, he helped me develop a full practice and I've never looked back from there. So I am forever grateful to Alan Tomaszewski for coming into my life and becoming one of my best friends and also having enough faith in me to really help me launch my career. I don't think that's a coincidence. Again, I think it's kind of a miraculous situation. Again, every time I talk to Alan, I tell him how much I love him and how much his presence in my life was so instrumental. So again, I've had other experiences that, you know, I've had to advocate for myself when I was told that, you know, there wasn't a problem. I ended up needing bypass surgery. I advocated telling the doctor I was going to die if I didn't have something done. He didn't believe me, but he decided to humor me by doing an angiogram, found out that all five of my coronary arteries are blocked. And the only reason they couldn't tell was because I was so active that the peripheral circulation kind of took the place of the major arteries. So I'm only here because I insisted that the doctors take me seriously when I would tell them I was dying, and there was no medical evidence to support that. So I've been really lucky as far as all this goes, and I've continued to have some really remarkable experiences, including actually doing this podcast. When I had to give up surfing, it was an incredibly painful loss, and I wasn't sure what to do with myself, and I woke up one day sort of with the idea that I should write a book, and then after that, do a podcast, and the book may never get published, but certainly the podcast is thriving, and I'm having a really fun time. So those are the kind of miracles that I kind of look at in my own life. I know there's other ones that I'm forgetting to talk about, but I've also experienced lots of miracles with people that I know. About 10 years ago, I was referred a young man who did a very, very serious suicide attempt. He was as close to killing himself as anybody that could and still survived. He had taken a lethal dose of drugs and alcohol up in the hills in Santa Barbara and was kind of laying in the bushes dying. But there are two women who were driving home past the place that he was. It's a place called Lizard's Mouth. And one of the women said to the other one just spontaneously, "Hey, you ever been to Lizard's Mouth?" And the other woman said, "I have no idea what that even is." And she said, "Well, if you have some time, let's go watch the sunset up there." So they drive to Lizard's Mouth. There's nobody there. There is one car in the parking lot there. And so they're walking. And all of a sudden, one of the women kind of looked off to the side and saw some clothing in the bushes. And she went over to take a look. And it turns out that this fellow was on death's door from a lethal alcohol and drug overdose. And the only reason they found them was because she just had a feeling that she needed to go and show her friend Lizard's Mouth. They got a medevac helicopter to come and save his life. And when he first came to see me, he was really upset that he'd survived. He was very determined to die. But I actually ran into this fellow about, maybe 6 months ago. And he's actually now training to be a therapist. He's in really great shape and spent a lot of time in therapy healing and coming to terms with why he wanted to die and so on and so forth. And now he wants to devote his life to the service of others. So I look at that as a fairly miraculous situation. Another situation that comes to my mind that I call the grilled cheese miracle. I know it sounds like funny. It's not a funny story, but one of my clients went to work one day. He's a builder. And all morning long, he was just craving a grilled cheese sandwich. He just couldn't stop thinking about wanting to have a grilled cheese sandwich no matter what. He kept telling himself, you know, why do I want grilled cheese? I don't eat grilled cheese very often. There's no restaurant I can go to get a grilled cheese sandwich. They don't sell them to adults. You know, that's mostly on the kids' menu. But he just couldn't stop thinking about wanting to have a grilled cheese sandwich. So he decided to go home for lunch, walked in the door, and he found his wife almost dead from a suicide attempt. And if he wasn't craving grilled cheese, he would have come home from work and found her dead. So I call that the grilled cheese miracle because she's alive because he couldn't stop thinking about having a grilled cheese sandwich. And I thought that was a really amazing story. I've heard lots of other, you know, stories about amazing coincidences that happen or amazing miracles that take place. Some of them are relatively minor. Others are, they take your breath away because they're like, how does that happen? Because it's just so beyond imagination that some things happen. You know, sometimes there are really positive miracles, like my meeting Karuna and being taught what love felt like. Other times, you know, miracles happen that keep you alive. I think that the most important part of what I'm really trying to say is whether you believe in miracles or not, I think that the information that people get, generally speaking, comes from their intuition. And I know I've talked about this many times before, but I really believe that as people, our intuition is our divine connection. Some people believe in God, so it would be a divine connection to God. You know, some people would call it the higher path, you know, your higher self, your collective unconscious. I don't care what the words are that a people would, you can describe it as being the flow. Whatever it might be that we're able to tap into on a really deep level, I think is there to enhance our lives, to keep us alive, and to also enhance our creativity and help us come up with sort of novel solutions to problems, just other things that, you know, can really change your life. I think about when I was about, maybe 40, late 40s, I had a really serious neck injury that made it so painful for me to surf that I thought I wouldn't be able to do it anymore. But I thought to myself, there's got to be something I can do. Got to be something. There's got to be some way for me to keep surfing, despite the fact that it's as painful and difficult as it could be. And I remember sitting in my chair with my eyes closed and, again, asking God, okay, I need a solution. I really need some help because you know how important surfing is to me, and I don't want to give it up, but I need something to ease the pain. So I got a crystal clear picture in my mind of an invention that I needed to come up with that would take the strain off my neck when I was paddling my surfboard. It was a very clear vision, and I remember being so elated that if I could figure out a way to do it, that it would solve the problem. Now, I'm not an inventor, and I'm not really that handy. I'm the guy that goes to Home Depot 20 times before the problem is solved. So anyway, I'm messing around with materials, trying to figure out how to build this thing that I saw in my head. And I'm, you know, over the time getting really frustrated because I can't find the right combination of materials. So I'm in my garage one day swearing and throwing stuff around. And my sweet daughter comes out and says, Dad, you know, could you keep it down? Why are you screaming out here? And I said, well, I'm just trying to figure out how to, you know, build this stupid thing. And she looked at me innocently and said, well, why don't you just build it out of wetsuit material? What's your problem? And I just had a flash of, yeah, what is my problem? So I went to a dive shop and showed them a picture of what I wanted, and they made it for me. And it was not something that was ever invented before, but it was designed to take the strain off my neck when I paddled my surfboard. And even though it was kind of funny looking, it really changed my relationship with my body completely. And I was able to spend another at least 10 or 15 years surfing with this device that I invented. And I don't think it ever would have happened unless I was, you know, praying for a miracle. So again, another example of the positive side of things, not just keeping you alive, but also, you know, helping you find solutions to different kinds of problems. And, you know, again, I know I'm sort of rambling on, but recently I was listening to a podcast and the guy that was being interviewed is a really famous actor. And he was talking about how important his dreams are and how much his dreams have been prophetic about his life. And he was talking about what it was like when he was one of the stars of a movie back in the year 2000. And he woke up one morning after having probably one of the most vivid dreams he's ever had in his life. And he said that what he dreamt was that he had a really, really serious brain tumor, but he had not had any symptoms. He had no headaches, no seizures, nothing that would have indicated that he had this problem. So he had a conversation with the physician that was part of the crew on this particular movie, and he mentioned to her that he had this dream. And she said, well, you know, you can always have an MRI. It's not that big of a deal. And, you know, he felt so compelled to take this dream seriously that he ended up having an MRI. And it turns out he had what would have been a fatal brain tumor if it stayed longer in his brain but he was able to, he was able to fortunately have it operated on and taken out of his head, and he has no residual symptoms. And so he got a miracle in the form of a dream. So I think that miracles can happen in all kinds of different ways, many shapes and sizes. I know that lots of people have solved problems in their dreams that are really pressing and important to them. So it can happen in your waking life, and it can happen in your sleep. It can happen by the chance meeting of another person. There are all kinds of situations in life that can be pretty miraculous. Again, I don't know if these things qualify as true miracles. They do to me, but I think, I guess, miracles are in the eye of the beholder. Because when I, again, talked to a lot of people about doing this particular podcast, a lot of people were skeptical and saying, well, you know, those things sound more like coincidences or sort of, you know, yeah, they are great stories, but I don't know if they qualify as miracles. I guess I would like to believe that they are, because I think it's really important for people to have faith that if you're willing to listen and willing to really respect and look at your intuition as a very sacred part of your existence, and you're willing to trust that it is there to help you in many different ways, both to enhance your life and also maybe even save your life, that you can develop a relationship with your intuition that is very hard to alter. Because one of the things that most people tell me when I ask them about their intuition is they say, yeah, my intuition is pretty strong, but it's very, very difficult for me to trust that it's real, because a lot of times the things that I feel and that I get, I can't prove it. And if you can't prove it, then it's really hard to trust it. But my response is, well, sometimes the proof comes later, and that it takes a leap of faith, which is what, you know, having a spiritual life is all about, is having faith that there is a part of you that knows the truth. There is a part of you that's very connected to what you need and don't need in your life. And that if you're willing to pay attention and really take it seriously, despite the fact that you cannot prove a lot of the things that come your way, that having proof is, you know, should not be the threshold that one uses to trust their intuition. I will say that a lot of people say to me, well, I can't tell the difference between my intuition and my fear. Right, I've had feelings sometimes that I shouldn't get on an airplane, you know, at a particular time, but I can't tell if it's because I hate airplanes and I'm nervous about flying, or really whether this is an airplane that, you know, may not be safe. So I understand that it's hard sometimes to distinguish between one's intuition and fear. It's a huge issue, and I don't discount it. In my life, when I feel really frightened by something, but I also have a strong feeling, I usually ask for help. The most recent circumstance that this happened in my life was about a year or so ago. I had a cat that was very ill, and I was really sad because the cat was about 14 years old. I loved this cat, and it was just breaking my heart that it was dying, and I could tell that it was really suffering. But I was also afraid to put it to sleep, to end its life, because I thought, you know, I don't want to do this because I am feeling bad. I want to do it because it's time to put the cat out of its misery. So that morning that I had these feelings, I went for a walk in the park, and I was listening to music and walking through the park, and I was talking to God saying, hey, I'm so scared of making the wrong decision here. I really need some help in deciding whether now is the time to put little Ben down. So I'm walking through the park. I'm listening to Sting, who is a, you know, famous performer. And the song that came playing in my head at that moment was Free, Free, Set Them Free, which is a fairly profound song in unto itself. And then I looked down on the sidewalk, and in chalk, there was a huge drawing of a clock right under my feet. And on top of the clock, it said, in very bold print, it's time. So I'm hearing Free, Free, Set Him Free, and I see a clock, and it says it's time over the clock. Now, again, you could just say that that was a coincidence, but I can't even tell you how profound that experience was to be given that direct confirmation that it wasn't my fear talking, that it really was time. Now, I can't say that I felt good because I was so sad about losing my cat, but I was able to come home and tell my wife that I just had this amazing experience of confirmation that it was okay to put Ben down. So again, I was brokenhearted, but I wasn't afraid. So again, I think that one of the things I ask people to do a lot when they're confused about fear and intuition is to try to develop a conversation and ask for help to be able to distinguish between what the real feelings are that are driving your perceptions on an intuitive level. Again, I really, I'm a big person on trusting my intuition. I will rarely, if ever, compromise when something feels a certain way, because all I hear over and over again in my professional practice is when people don't listen because they're scared or because they don't like the answer, that disaster is very shortly, comes upon them. I can't tell you how many times in relationships people get a feeling like the person that they're in a relationship with is probably not the best person for them to be with. But because they're scared of being alone, or they feel like it's the best relationship they've ever had, or they feel like maybe they could change the person, they go ahead and make a commitment. And then years later, the very thing that they were concerned about comes back to haunt them in a very major way, sometimes causing the end of a marriage. So, I always say to people, well, did you have a feeling, strong feeling that maybe you were making a mistake? And everybody universally has said to me, yeah, but there's always a but. And then I hear the excuses that people make. And then I ask them, well, what were you thinking? And usually the answer I get is what I call magical thinking. Again, I thought he would change. I thought you would change. I didn't think it was that big of a deal. I figured maybe I could convince the person, whatever the magical thoughts are that people approach trying to solve serious problems in a relationship usually end up obviously not working and creating a disaster. So that's another reason why I'm so big on the intuition thing, because most of these people got a feeling, a strong feeling that, they may have been marrying the wrong person, or that they were involved with somebody they shouldn't be involved in on some level. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it even happens in a business sense. There's a fellow I know that I met recently who got into a business deal with somebody that he absolutely knew was the wrong person to get into business with. But because he was desperate and scared that he might not find anybody else, he convinced himself that, that it was going to turn out okay. And in the end, he got robbed by the person. The person, embezzled all kinds of money from him, and it turned into a big disaster. And the biggest problem is that he knew better, and he feels really embarrassed that he convinced himself to do something that he had no business doing, and he knew that he shouldn't do it. But, fear is a driver in most of our lives, and if we don't have a lot of faith to counter that fear, it makes it really difficult not to give in to the fear and make poor decisions. So again, I'm probably belaboring the point, but I am here to tell you that I've experienced tons of miracles. I've seen lots of miracles happen. I believe that most of the time we get little miracles or little things that happen that kind of move us along in our lives. And then for me, because I'm so stubborn, I have to have big miracles in order to take them seriously. So I'm assuming why I've had such big things happen. I'm a hard sell, and it's really hard to convince me unless it's so dramatic that I can't figure out a way to deny what's taking place. So in that way, I kind of make fun of myself, but I do appreciate when amazing things happen that renew my faith and help me move along in a positive way in my life. Thank you for listening. I hope that you will all consider the miracles that maybe you've experienced, and look forward to having future miracles take place in your life, because I think that the more that you open yourself up, the more likely it is that you're going to have some fairly miraculous circumstances take place. I want to thank everybody for listening to the Fear Me Out podcast. I really appreciate the feedback that I've gotten about, how much it's helped people. That's the main reason I'm doing it. And so again, thanks for listening. If you enjoy the podcast, I'm hoping you will subscribe. The best place to find all the episodes is on my website, which is fearmeoutpodcast.com or danasaperstein.com. And please tell your friends. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. Remember, if you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation to the Fear Me Out podcast, please go to www.jccs.org and earmark your donation to this podcast. If you need more information about making a donation, you can contact Dr. Saperstein directly at 805-452-0006. Thank you.